Ouch.
We're ready to boogie down here and scratch some records as we talk about the early origins of hip-hop and how it started in this business on Half True History. And thank you again, everyone, for listening to Half True History, where we take the facts of today, the legends of yesterday, and put them together for a pretty good story that you should enjoy. I am your professor for the half hour, Dan P.
MC Dan P.
MC Dan P. That's right. Right. We got to do that here. Yeah. And now, spinning our wheels of steel over here. Crush Chris Crespo.
DJ Crush Crespo.
Of course.
And then, of course, I want to give us a good duo here. Oh, yeah. I think, like, the Will Smith to my Jazzy is definitely going to be Pedro Lima.
There you go. Yeah. Jam Master P. Uh-huh. There it is. Oh, soundboard, I miss you.
So.
Rest in peace, Biz Markie. It's been a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. But we didn't forget about you. I was supposed, before COVID, I had bought tickets to see him perform at House of Blues.
Oh.
And because of COVID, it got canceled.
Yes. Mm.
And it was the year that I said, you know what? I'm going to go and start going to concerts.
Yeah.
Like more. Because every time a concert would come, I'm like, man, that's expensive. And then I got to see J Balvin. Mm-hmm. And that changed my whole thing about expensive. You know what I mean? Because it's kind of like, man, it's a whole different experience going to a concert.
Right.
But
I bit the financial bullet a little bit. I'm going to the Rock Fest in Daytona to see Metallica and Rob Zombie.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, let's do it.
And Rob Zombie?
Rob Zombie.
Nice.
Yes.
Oh, dude.
Dragula.
Can I tell you, Rob Zombie's White Zombies.
White Zombie. Mm-hmm.
Astro Key 2000.
Yeah.
That was stolen from me twice.
That's because it's such a great album.
Yeah. Dude, I used to go to sleep with that album on.
The
Thunder Kids with me. It's just the way that he mixed everything. Yeah, it's just.
I mean, my opinion is that Rob Zombie creatively peaked with both White Zombie albums, with Astro Creep. After Astro Creep, it's been all downhill for Rob.
Yeah, because then Rob, then when
his
it was
solo
Rob
stuff
Zombie.
Is blah. Well, I'd rather listen to that album than watch any of his movies.
Hellbilly Deluxe wasn't bad though. I enjoyed Hellbilly.
That's the one with Dracula.
Dracula.
Yeah.
Dracula.
That's Dracula. But then after that,
and then his brother had a
Power Man 5000.
Yeah, he had that one song
When Worlds Collide.
That was
That
was good to work out with.
Well, it's a one song.
Yeah, well, I said one song.
Well, I stick to my original statement. White Zombies, Astro Creep is the pinnacle. Rob Zombie's career. Yeah. And since then, it's been pointy cowboy hats and Halloween remakes. He's making the Munsters now.
Yeah, is he?
Yeah.
Well, I was waiting for the hockey movie.
Yeah, he
I was
the
waiting for the Thousand Corpses movies was good.
House of a Thousand Corpses is good.
I appreciate him as a filmmaker and his style more than I actually like him as
the
a
The Halloween okay. movies, not for nothing. I loved the first one he did. Mm-hmm. I did not watch the second one. But I remember telling Arnie Ellis, yo, you gotta watch this Halloween remake. And it kind of like, oh.
Right. Mm-hmm. He's got a great appreciation for horror, too. You know, and I really like his albums because he somehow sucks you into the universe when you listen to that. Yeah. Like, you're in his weird world
That's
when you're
true.
Listening to those
yeah,
albums.
What, yeah, what metal thing starts with bongos?
Yeah.
Outside of South America?
Yeah. He'll incorporate Nicaraguan pan flutes into a heavy drift. He was supposed to do this hockey movie about the Philadelphia Flyers.
Okay.
From the 70s. And it Something happened, and it just stopped.
People woke up and realized Rob Zombie was making a hockey movie, and that wasn't a great idea. About,
because that team,
or were they about to become like vampires at the end of the game and kill everyone in the arena?
That team might as well be vampires,
yeah,
because they were goons.
It was gonna be like Slapshot for real.
Oh, the goon squad. Yeah, dude. Yeah. The 70s mm-hmm. Flyers teams were terrified to play them.
Yeah.
Like old school hockey. If you go on YouTube, you can find clips of hockey players going to the stands, grabbing a fan's shoe and beating them with it. And nobody got like lifetime suspension or anything like that.
Yeah, you're in Philly. You understand what's going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, you know what's up.
They threw batteries at Santa Claus. Yeah, that's a different town, man. Yeah. They do things different there.
Santa did say a couple slurs.
You gotta roll with it. You gotta roll with it.
Yeah. Rudolph is a known racist.
Mm-hmm. he likes a drink. That's why the nose is red.
Yeah, he does. It's all alcoholic. That snow.
It's like, I keep telling you, Santa. They're lazy.
Switching from heavy metal, though, to hip-hop now.
Yay!
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What was the last hip-hop show you've been to?
God.
I haven't I mean...
Public Enemy.
Yes, we went to the Public Enemy concert.
Ooh, that's fun.
At Firestone?
It was Firestone. It's whatever it's called now, but yeah. Very nice. And the dopest part was the guy that opened was a hip hop violinist.
Yes.
And dude was kicking ass.
Wow, that's cool.
And the second best part was when Public Enemy is singing Fight the Power and stuff like that. And Chuck D puts it out to the audience, and the audience had no idea what the words were.
Oh, that's sad. Oh, man.
It was so good. That's funny. He had the Nation of Islam out there too. Nice. It was good. It was good times.
Sounds fun.
Man, that has been a while. I should go to another one. But, so history of hip hop is an interesting kind of how it got into the mainstream. And once again, I mean, just like rock and roll and jazz, it's got to get pioneered by black folks and then featured by white folks in order to actually get into the beat there. So when we get to the origins, let's get to the 1970s here, and we get to the origins of early hip hop, and even before the 1970s. Oh, is this
Did that do the wrong one?
No, it was the disco one because we're in the 70s, right? Yeah. Right. We're not there yet. There you go. Now we're in disco days. Hi, Roland. And one of the earliest versions of what we, you know, really consider rapping came from the DJs switching records in these disco stations and such. The biggest one was in New York. His name was Frankie Crocker. And he was just this slick guy who would just rhyme and rap as the last music went on, would keep going until he switched the other record and would let that play and would speak over it with his own rhymes and raps and such. And it became a popular thing to have this filler that was still, you could still dance to, essentially.
So he would just be like, hey, everybody, hope you're having a great day. I got Donna Summers playing.
But doing it on beat.
On beat, yeah.
Right, doing it on beat and rhyming and everything like that. Like, so
this is the new sound on the street. Time for that fresh heat.
Yeah.
Got some of that Donna Summer.
So, pretty much, yeah. And just that nice transition. And he was the king of radio in the 1970s.
Son of Sam killed four. Here's Donna Summer. Get on that dance floor.
There you go. You nailed it. About. What's this guy's name again?
Frankie Crocker. He was the king of black music, black radio, really, in the 1970s.
Please tell me he's black.
Oh, he is.
Okay.
Like, we're talking about a guy who, I believe the legend is, or the myth, I don't know if it's real or not, but he rode like a horse into Studio 54 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Like, just this kind of like
cocaine is a hell of a drug.
In Miami,
they've done that too. They brought a horse one time to the nightclub. This is 2017, I think it was.
Oh, it was just a couple years ago.
Yeah, they just brought the horse into the club.
Right. So a lot of DJs try to copy the style because he was just so hot. He was just so popular. People would listen to Frankie, and Frankie would sometimes, you know, he'd play the song, but sometimes he would join in and even like halfway through the song and just go through it, and they loved it. They just liked his additions. Hmm. So it gets so popular that disco parties, if you're going to be a DJ at a disco party, you're expected to have a little bit of rhythm, have a little bit of rap in you, essentially. And that's what they called it, rapping, just talking in between the songs.
Yeah, literally just rapping, brother.
Right, yeah, exactly. So again, it starts.
So you just needed a couple bars for the next track, and mm-hmm. that's it.
Yeah.
Just need a few bars. You had to have the, you know, make people want to keep dancing. You know, put the hands in the air like they just don't care. That kind of stuff. You know. Starts in New York is really where it really picks up. We see some of the first DJs, and I believe one of them is being DJ Hollywood. Was a popular one as well.
All the way in the beginning, all the good names are available. Mm-hmm. DJ Hollywood, come on, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. You got first dibs on all those names.
DJ Hollywood, you had Cool Herc, you had some of these, Mr. Magic. So they were coming up, and it was still an AM world though. Rap style had not hit the FM world just yet. We're still on the AMs here for a lot of these. And
but FM is like the go-to frequency now, right? It's taking over AM at this point.
FM's like HBO. Yes. Right. The premier stuff.
Yeah. Sounds cleaner, more stations.
Right. And you had to get to how do you get to FM, but at this point, that rap style was still seen as so crude and really just made for nightclubs and just...
It's almost a novelty.
A novelty, they thought. Also kind of this idea
the money's in disco, daddy-o.
Right, exactly. And it didn't appeal to white people.
Yeah, man, it's not Conway Twitty.
Because a lot of the time they would rap about... Conway Twitty. Yeah. Because they would rap about a lot of black problems or black... Brock brands they were wearing or something like that. Sure, so none of it really clicked with white people.
Yeah.
Conway Twitty does I was on Tom and Dan a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And they played this song, Conway Twitty, of him hitting on a chick at a bar.
Yeah.
And he's just straight up rapping to her kind of things and making her be like, I know you're married, but you know what's up.
That's Conway Twitty.
Conway Twitty.
When he had mutton chops like that, he could pretty much just throw it around.
You got those in the 70s, you're gold.
Yeah. This man is virile.
Just right. Swatting it away. Just get away.
Drowning in it.
Yeah.
So eventually the idea was just playing the instrumentals. The DJs would switch the, and scratch and everything, being able to just really play most of the instrument parts, switch the songs back and forth, and it was an art form to DJ back then with those turntables. Mm-hmm. It became a real a skill to be able to just go seamlessly from song to song while still being able to you either be the rapper itself, or you would have a guy up there, your hype man, doing the raps while you were switching off. Mm. So it was very popular, very big. I believe I'm gonna get this. I don't want to get this borough wrong, but I think it starts in the Brooklyn. Bronx. Is it Bronx? Okay. It's Bronx. Well, I knew it was Bronx or Brooklyn that it really starts picking up. But Bronx, yeah, that sounds about that.
I only know because I watched The Get Down on Netflix. Oh, The Get Down,
yes.
Which is, the first part is amazing.
Yeah.
The second part would be like, just don't bother with it. Just...
If you want a really good source of information, this is where I got a lot of my information from. It's a... it's called The Big Payback.
Okay.
It's a history of the entire hip-hop business from the 1970s into the early 2000s.
Wow. Okay.
And it really focuses, again, on the business aspects of everything.
We hear you.
Whoa. Hold on, man.
God, relax. Come on, we're doing a show here. Jesus. The Big Payback.
The Big Payback. Great book.
That's a great James Brown song, too.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really talks, gets into the business and everything. And... Frankie,
that's
when
a
he
great rapper too, James Brown. Yeah, I don't know karate.
Actually, yeah,
but I know crazy.
I mean, you gotta start somewhere.
Woman, talk back to me. Get the back of the fist.
He's always like,
"Whoa, wait, what?"
Yeah,
what
happened? Like James, relax.
James,
he was on beat. At least he was on beat.
Yeah, that's on coke and on beat.
So good. That combo is just amazing.
Yeah. But Frankie didn't want to play any of that rap. they were trying to see if they could get a market out there. Frankie, first off, didn't like the idea of anybody overthrowing his style or him being the FM DJ that was able to play this, hear this stuff. So Frankie...
Oh, he thought it was, this is my signature.
Fought it back a little bit. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so it takes a little while. Again, the DJs start selling their own samples and mixes, you know, in these little corner stores or wherever. And then finally, in New Jersey, a group gets together to say, well, let's try and create an album of this. Let's see if we can sell. Let's see if we can actually big market this. And it's done by a woman named Sylvia and her husband. And they create Sugar Hill Records. Sugar Hill, the term Sugar Hill comes from the Harlem Heights area.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was just a mountain of cocaine.
Right?
And that's what they just called it as a nickname.
Apparently in the...
Hey, let me get some of that Sugar Hill inspiration.
During the Harlem Renaissance, the area of Harlem Heights was the nice area, so it was the sweet life to live up there. And they nicknamed it Sugar Hill. So they wanted to borrow from that Harlem callback and named it Sugar Hill Productions.
There we go.
It's funny, I was talking to my buddy Tion. Mm-hmm. When we used to work at MTV would throw the Christmas parties.
Right.
And they had Sugar Hill as one of the performers one time. And then after the party, the whole company, they rent out like a theater kind of thing and a big shindig. And the Sugar Hill gang's walking around, a little older and stuff like that, just getting lit.
Yeah.
Stuff yeah, they're not paying for. They got paid to be there.
Yeah. Oh, but it was so good.
That's a good deal.
What's great about the Sugar Hill Gang is that they weren't the best rappers out there, right? When they were forming, they were the cheapest.
Somebody held out for a couple more bucks.
They wanted Kool Herc and DJ Hollywood to start off, but they wanted too much money. They said, "Why would I give up my weekends recording when I make three times as much as you want to pay me right now?" But
wow,
DJ Hollywood's had assistants, of course, that did stuff for him. One of his boys said, "Hey, listen, they contacted me. Do you mind if I take a couple of your lines to do it?" And he said, and DJ Hollywood laughed at him and said, "Yeah, man, whatever. You ain't shitty. You ain't going anywhere. Go ahead, take my rights." And he named himself Big Bang Hank.
Big Bang Hank!
And this is most of DJ Hollywood's stuff.
That's funny.
That he's going to end up banking on.
We don't know shit about DJ Hollywood.
We all know Sugar Hill.
We know Sugar Hill Gang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's funny.
DJ Hollywood will try to make his own years later to no success because all of his lyrics had already been bit and used in all the early stuff.
Yeah.
Because he gave him the permission. He didn't think nothing was going to happen.
He's like, just go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy. Is he still alive?
I don't know. I gotta check that out, but that's...
Because I'm pretty sure he took that to his grave. You know, this shit that's going on. We did a little yachty. That came from me. I started this shit.
You know, and Sylvia gets into it as well. She does her own little rap song, It's Good to Be the Queen, which Mel Brooks parodies in To Be or Not to Be. So I think that's probably how it gets famous, is by Mel Brooks making fun of it.
But, okay... But doesn't Blondie get a lot of credit for this shit?
That's where we're going. So this is the first rap album, 79. And at the time, a lot of urban culture is starting to get into with the indie rockers as well. And Blondie hooks up and starts hanging out with a graffiti artist named Fab Five Freddy. And he takes her to clubs, and she goes to those clubs and such. And so in 1980, she debuts the song Rapture, and that will be the first time rap is heard on the major radio stations. Right, yeah. So Sugar Hill will come out with it just a few months before.
Fat Five Freddy.
DJ said, "Did mama." That's it. And then that will be the first time America is introduced to rap is through Blondie's Rapture.
Because this is on FM stations.
Yes. So yeah, because Blondie was getting a lot of play. She was in
the video. I absolutely
helped. I mean, Deborah Harry. Come on, man.
Yeah, she's great. Gorgeous. I mean, it was at the time. It was a great indie rock band that was getting a lot of press. It was getting a big
but
push.
But the beat would play in every nightclub there is. You know what I mean? So.
And if you listen, it's not uncommon to the Sugar Hill, which is basically Good Times by Chic. And it goes back to that original DJs talking over already made songs. So it's always interesting when people who don't really understand hip-hop try to insult hip-hop songs by saying, oh, that's not even their music. It's not supposed to be. It never was. It was always taking the beat of something else and making it into something else.
There's always
else.
A repurposing.
Right. Yeah, it's not... It's
recycling.
Exactly.
Something that you thought was shitty, look what I grabbed. You know who's
it got
awesome?
Upcycled.
Exactly.
What was that?
LP. LP is LP. Phenomenal.
Heck yeah.
He goes to...
RDJ?
He goes to music stores. LP from Run the Jewels.
Okay, yeah.
He goes to a music store. He puts a blindfold on, grabs 3 records.
Nice.
And to see if he can come out with a beat from it.
He's like, let's see what we got here. That's Hillbilly Deluxe. Oh, this is a tough one. Yeah. Oh, boy.
The Muppet Takes Manhattan soundtrack.
I got it.
That's a great soundtrack.
And the soundtrack to Gandhi. And he'll come up with a badass beat.
Yeah, he will. Give it to Killer Mike. It's over.
It used to get a lot of, especially in the 90s. I remember the person who got the most flack was Puff Daddy. For the Led Zeppelin thing. It's like, and even MTV was like, oh, he's using other people's songs to make hits. And I'm like, that was
it's always
rap,
been the
point. Though, bro. That's always been.
Yeah, Vanilla Ice, right? People will dog him when they're like, wait a second, this isn't the same as the Queen.
In his defense, his beats went. And his goes ding, 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 ding.
It's the ding.
Right.
The difference. Yeah, absolutely.
So.
How much did he end up paying settling
for?
A lot.
For that interview alone, Shook should have just shuck him off the balcony.
Should have dropped him.
So it starts to get a following. Sugar Hill starts to pick up a little bit. And you're getting these smaller companies trying to compete with Sugar Hill. Obviously, Sugar Hill's got the advantage. And then Sugar Hill picks up Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And that becomes really, because Sugar Hill Gang, they were great, but they only had a few songs in them.
Yeah, novelty kind of thing.
They needed talent, and they picked up Flash and his crew. And this is the start of kind of like this DJ arms race that's going on. Everyone's trying to find and go to every single club in New York trying to find the next hottest DJ. Come on, girls, let's rock that. Sugar Hill had the advantage. Sugar Hill was the bigger label, but also Sugar Hill was the biggest dicks to their client. They owned pretty much everything. They didn't let them, they put out albums as they wanted to. You really didn't have a lot of control and creativity or even a lot of royalties out of the money, out of the records sold if you worked for Sugar Hill.
Mm-hmm.
But since they were the only game that got recognition at this time, you know, it was still something you wanted to do. So, and it's right after they get Grandmaster Flash, they get another hit with Curtis Blow and Christmas Rapping, and then just keep going from there. But there's going to be obviously challenges to it. And sometimes now they're going to head out, some people are heading out of New York as well. Maybe there's people in New Jersey, maybe there's people in Philadelphia.
It starts spreading out from New York.
It becomes a big rush, and once a group starts up, we're all classmates at the University of Delphi in New York, and one of them, who's one of the bigger proponents to start getting more independent artists, is the original Dr. Dre.
The big Dr. Dre from Yo MTV Raps.
And from Yo MTV Raps. He's the first one to really start.
Ed Lover and Dr. Dre.
Yes.
Yep.
Did they do, what was the movie they did? Not Car, was it the Car 54 Where Are You or the other
no.
one?
No.
What was the cop movie they did?
Yeah.
Right? Come on, guys. We're all the same age.
Because
Rough as Leather is the T.
Oh my god.
Tough as Hell. Is it Tough as Hell? Tough as Leather. That's the DM. That's the Run DMC
yeah,
movie.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. I know.
Right. Right. Talking yeah.
About too, Dennis Leary's in it.
Dennis Leary's in it. There's a bunch that like.
Do you know this? Do you know the movie?
I've seen it. I've seen it. But that's why remember. I brought it up. I just can't think of the title.
And that was what, you know. There's so yeah, and so many of the guys.
Yeah.
Get the. I think the Treacherous Three are in there. I think Kumail D's in there.
Yeah, for sure. It was like a hip hop cavalcade mm-hmm. of people when I was 10, 11 years old, and yep. I recognized most of them. But mm-hmm. I was like, those are the Yo MTV Raps dudes.
Yep.
When I was a kid.
Exactly. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And. They're gonna eventually become the ones who, yeah, help create yeah. the Yo MTV Raps yeah, show and bring it into
big deal.
Yeah, and it was a huge deal. And do you know actually, Yo MTV Raps first started out in MTV Europe because they didn't know how successful it was gonna of be. Of course, in the US
who's
first.
The man?
Who's the man? Yes. Okay, that makes sense. Because the cops, who's the man? The
right,
man.
Who's the man? Okay. Yeah.
He played Sergeant Cooper.
Of course.
I would never remember that. makes sense that they would be like, I don't know, this is going to be good. Let's put it on in Europe.
Right, let's see. Let's see if the Swedes like these black guys first. What?
Yeah.
If the super white people like them, right. Maybe they'll go well with our white people.
That's weird.
So you got this Adelphi College cabal that's happening as well. And they're all hustling. As best they can. But again, it's still not getting to the FM. No one's getting to that Blondie level.
Yeah.
Because rap is still so niche and the audiences are just not ready for it. One of the bigger hustlers at the time is Russell Simmons.
Yes.
Who really wants to get his brother's group going.
Mm-hmm.
Run DMC.
Yes.
And so they... got a new unique style. It's not as disco-y and poppy as the older stuff. It's got a little bit more of a city edge. But they're still not able to figure out how to get the traction until they go to the dorm room of a this college student named Rick Rubin.
What does this white guy know about our music?
Exactly. And he's like, have you thought about bringing some rock into it? And so they create Raising Hell together, and that's Rush Records, which is going to be Simmons, and then Def Jam for Rubens. And that rock riff sells it.
It did it. It pushed it into the mainstream.
Yeah.
But that's not the one that puts them over.
Nope. At all.
Same album. It's the same album.
And it's a two-for-one deal.
Yes.
It did revitalize, yes.
Go ahead.
Because they brought back Aerosmith.
Uh-huh.
Who I think their big album was in 75 or something right. like that.
Dream Toys in the On? Attic or something?
Dream On.
What was that one? Dream On the name of the album?
No, that was like the big hit. Because I think
they were big in the 70s generally. They had a lull in the 80s.
Because they weren't, yeah.
Yeah.
It was hair metal at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But they're gonna help Aerosmith to kind of make that comeback, right, with Walk This Way.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're still not ready, though. Yeah, Run DMC is popular. Yeah, they can open. But we need to serve up. We need to serve America white people first, rapping, in order for it to get established.
Cue in Stephen Perry.
Cue in three Jewish boys.
No, it's not Stephen Perry.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
So the Beastie Boys pretty much come at the same time as Run DMC, and they're... For black clubs, they open for Run DMC, and for the white clubs, Run DMC opens for them.
Oh, all right. Wow.
Yeah.
It's like the 1980s version of the Green Book.
And the Beastie Boys, they hit it off. Fight for your right to party and stuff. It's punk rock, it's rap at the same time. And with that, Run DMC also gets big with the white audiences. And we are at the races of, you know, kind of that pre-modern hip hop of what we're about to see later. But it really is, you know, it comes from these small little MC worlds, and then they start spreading out. Now it's a music business. Now everyone's like, wow, how can we get better than Rush and Def Jam? And Def Jam is already going, like I said, beyond the cities. They are down in Philadelphia, and they go to Pittsburgh, and they down there while they're in Pennsylvania, they pick up Public Enemy. And
Public Enemy's from Long Island, though.
Is Public Enemy from Long Island?
Yeah,
I thought they picked them in Pittsburgh. Oh, that might
be my bad. I mean, they might have been performing in Pittsburgh.
Probably performed, yep.
Because I thought they're from Long Island.
They picked up Schoolie D down there, and interestingly enough, this is when they go down to listen to this DJ called Jazzy Jeff, and they almost don't sign him because the agent comes back and says his hype man is the most annoying, unfunny, untalented person I've ever met.
Gee, I wonder who that is.
And he will not, and Jeff will not leave without him. So yeah, we've got to put up with this asshole if we want him.
That's funny. Jazz knew where the money was at even then. Huh? It's so funny.
Yep. And yeah, if it wasn't for Jazzy Jeff sticking to his guns, Will Smith might not have.
You wouldn't have had a parent just don't understand.
Right.
He was 17 years old when that song was on the radio. They played that at his high school prom.
I remember.
He went to his own prom and his song, the DJ played.
I remember the video and was like, oh, shit.
It looks like the intro to, they made the intro to the show look like the video, right? Yeah, the same style. Very smart.
Yeah, it almost didn't happen because the agent that went down there just got so annoyed with Will Smith.
That's funny. He was probably very annoying.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he was.
He's kind of annoying now still, you know. I love him. He's kind of annoying.
But you can imagine what a 16-year-old Will Smith is like in a club.
So much energy.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and it almost didn't work out there. So
16. Oh, my goodness. That's so young.
Right?
That's crazy.
They start.
And there was pretty much parody songs that they were. It felt like parody songs. Not
like joke songs for a younger audience, right, for sure.
I think I can knock out Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
They wanted to capture a lot of that Beastie Boy energy.
That's in what it was.
A black artist is kind of those like wildy teen
parties. It wasn't until Summertime. Fun times. Summertime was a song that was kind of like, okay.
Right. That's an actual song and not just joking
and
around.
And then, you know, then he came out with Wild Wild West and people lost their mind. And Willenium.
Wow, wow, wow.
And it was easier to sell Jazzy and Run DMC because they had a little bit more fun. It was harder to sell Public Enemy when they first came out. In fact, the story is, they like to tell it too. It's, one of the big DJs, Mr. Magic, called them absolute trash.
Wow.
And just crapped all over them in New York radio.
Wow.
So it was harder to sell people like Public Enemy, but eventually, of course, they do find their, Rick is able to find their niche and move into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's, you know, and then of course there are countless names that we haven't mentioned yet, obviously, because this is just an overview. I definitely recommend you get the book, The Big Payback, to read a little bit more. And for a while, the East Coast becomes this dominant place, and until a hip-hop alpha in Los Angeles starts to come up, known as the World Class Wrecking Crew. And that is with two of their DJs, MC Yella and Dr. Dre. And that's where they are going to start. And so that then the West will start to rise up and they're going to be trying to hit harder issues and be a little bit rougher than the East Coast, which is going to start. Yeah.
Did Dr. Dre know about Dr. Dre?
I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think they went to the same medical school.
So. I mean, yeah. I mean, you got one from Compton, one from New York. It's
literal opposite then, sides of the country.
Right.
No internet.
Stuff doesn't travel the same
exactly.
way.
Exactly. It's not. I mean, he probably found out about him when Yo MTV Raps came out.
He's like, man, that's my name.
Yeah.
He goes, that's Dre. Well, I'm West Coast Dr. Dre.
Well, no, I'm West Coast Dr. Dre.
So. And there,
And then Houston rap started coming out with the Ghetto Boys, and then Atlanta rap, and
the Dirty South rap,
then the Florida
then
rap,
the bass, Miami bass with 2 Live Crew.
Yeah.
Now there's a crew that's a
story.
Hard sell.
That's a story by itself.
Yeah, they themselves
they get their own chapter.
Uncle Luke gets his own. He gets his own world.
There's a thing Roy Woods Jr. does where he talks about the First Amendment and Luther Campbell. And at first, you're kind of like, it's like, oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Like, everything that Luther Campbell did is worthy of a Hall of Fame.
Luther, yeah, absolutely. Like, that Miami scene.
Because of him, there's the parental advisory, yeah, which if your album had that sticker, it was definitely going to sell.
Yep.
And like, it would sell more.
Depends on the genre.
Yeah.
And the time period.
But you're not going to...
Because after a while, Walmart became the biggest purveyor of music, published music in the country, and they refused to sell.
And they had the edited version.
So then you had to put out the edited version. Then you have
but you're not going to get a Michael Bolton parental advisory thing and be like, oh, this one's going to slap.
Right. And plus, early...
I mean, you don't know that. Michael Bolton hasn't done that yet. He could.
In the early 90s, it's still tons of record shops all over the place.
Yeah, early 90s for sure is different. I'm thinking more late 90s.
I do like Michael Bolton and Jack Sparrow, though.
That Jack Sparrow song.
This is a man, Captain Jack Sparrow.
Interesting trivia thing too. I was just looking up, doing more research. So Ludacris, he's Richard Pryor's cousin, which makes sense when you think about his lyrics. Yeah. Sometimes you're like, makes sense.
Also, a very tiny guy.
Yes,
so little.
He's just like Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was like, you know, that totally, I could see the influence now in those songs. Like,
that tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That tracks. So. Absolutely. Wow.
I like Luda. Luda is...
I love Luda, yeah. He's...
All he does now is Fast and Furious movies.
Hey, that's the...
Good for him. That's great. Good
comics,
for him.
Mm-hmm. Comics love stand-up until a bigger check appears. Right. And when that bigger check is like, oh, I only got to do a movie?
Moving on. Right.
Why do you like Luda? Like, what kind of grabs it?
When I was in New York, that album,
word of mouth.
And I still send to my cousin, this is good, straight to your mouth. Like whenever I'm talking about drinks, it's like, oh, this is great.
Exactly. I really enjoy. He made it ridiculous, but at the same time. You didn't want a guy.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
Like, it wasn't Sugar Hill.
It sounded real happy. Real enough.
Right.
It sounded real enough. Yeah, for sure.
That was good. So, everyone, that's our little take on how hip-hop formed.
Nice.
If we tried to branch into the 90s, we would be here for
hours. It gets so crazy in the 90s.
And that's why I'm going to encourage you to buy the book. Nice. Check out some other... there's some good documentaries on the subjects too. I can't think of any of mine. And then, like Pedro said,
there's some for like specific
groups. The Get Down is a fun little thing. It's not
Netflix, right?
It's not like 100% accurate or anything like that, but it gives you a nice little idea of.
It lets you know.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's kind of the Dolomite is My Name of hip-hop.
It's good enough.
Right.
Lets you know enough.
All right, let's get some closing music, put some wheels down, and wrap out of here.
Oh.
Uh-oh.
This is also the music that Dan Perella used to quit his job.
Yes.
And it's on, I think it's on
still
YouTube.
On YouTube, I suppose.
It's still on YouTube.
Nice.
God, how long was that?
It was 15, 16 years ago?
Yeah, gotta be 15 years ago. I want to say like 2006, 2005, somewhere around there. So there we go.
What was it? What's the name of that?
My Manager Quits. So if you type in My Manager Quits, that's when I was quitting from Moe's Southwest Grill.
Moe's Southwest Grill.
It was my college.
Standing on top of the tables, dancing.
My goodness. That's hysterical.
And then
it's
I clock prime, out.
It's prime Dan. It's definitely prime Dan. Yeah. So if you get to see that clip, you know, check it out. If there's a way that you can, if I find a link, can you put the link on the...
In the notes.
On the notes?
Yeah.
And they can see.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
My manager quit.
Yeah, for sure.
Such a young Daniel Perella.
So for everyone here, Chris Crespo, Pedro Lima, I am Dan P. This has been Half True History back in studio. And we'll see you on the next page.
Peace.
Bye.
top down so my hair can't blow. The girl is on standby, waving just to say hi. Did you stop? No, I just drove by, kept on pursuing to the next stop. I bust a left and I'm heading to the next stop. The block was dead, yo, so I continued to A1A, Beachfront Avenue. Girls were hot, women less than bikinis. Rock men lovers, driving Lamborghinis. Jealous, cause I'm out getting mine. Shade with the gauge and vanilla with the nine. Ready for the chumps on the wall. The chumps acting ill cause they're full of eight ball. Gunshots ranged out like a bell. I grabbed my nine, all I heard was shells falling on the concrete real fast. Jumped in my car, slammed on the gas. Bumper to bumper, the avenue's packed. I'm trying to get away before the jackers jack. Police on the scene, you know what I mean? They passed me up, confronted all the fiends. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it.
A PFT Media production.